Tell me about this new status update from the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
Yes, the IUCN, International Union for Conservation of Nature, is the globally accepted sort of international standard for assessing species extinction risks. And they take a look at these designations every 5 to 10 years and reassess them as necessary. So snow leopards were last assessed in 2008 and determined to be endangered. There's a new assessment that's been done by five experts from three international organizations, and the results of which have been reviewed and agreed to unanimously by approximately eight independent reviewers that down listed the assessment from endangered to vulnerable. So vulnerable is just a category that's a little lower at risk of extinction. I sort of prefer to call it an upgrade, actually, because what it means is we're moving closer towards taking the snow leopard off the endangered list.
So you were one of the experts on the evaluation committee. Where did you stand on this? And I understand also there was some opposition to the idea.
Yes, well, there are very specific guidelines that the IUCN has because they have to really standardize how you assess endangerment risk to a wide variety of mammals, plants, insects, and so on. And they have a set of criteria for each of these groups. We used the criteria, the only one we could really use, which is actually a general one that assesses the status of snow leopards globally. And as you know, they occur in 12 countries across Central Asia over a huge area that's about 700,000 square miles or something like that, so that it doesn't refer to the status of the snow leopard in a particular country, rather to the entire range. And there are two criteria that have to be met in order for an endangered classification to be provided. The first one is that the global population must consist of fewer than 2,500 mature adults. The second, that there should be an ongoing decline of 20% over 16 years, and that 16 years is judged to be two generations of snow leopard life. So you look back 16 years and you do an assessment of what you think the decline rate is, obviously broadly, because data is often lacking, as it is in this case, and we have to base it on the best knowledge that we had. In 2008, we did come up with fewer than 2,500 mature adults, but we used a discount rate that was not allowed, in fact. So this time, we took information from about 30 or 40 camera trap studies that are done around the snow leopard range, and we looked at what percent of individuals that were captured were likely cubs, obvious, or sub-adults, a little less obvious, but based on sign, you can make a judgment, the size of the animal, you can make a judgment. And we actually this time came up with the most we could discount anything for would be about 70% of the lowest population that most experts have agreed to. And that was 4,000 snow leopards. So about 70% of 4,000 snow leopard is a rough estimate of the number of mature adults, which of course is above the 2,500 figure. And a number of those camera trap studies, actually, I would say a majority of them showed more like, 80% adults. Furthermore, in many of those studies, the density of snow leopards was much higher than previously thought.
So that's obviously encouraging from that sample size, but it is a small sample size, and I think that that's the concern that some other conservation organizations had with the upgrading or downlisting of the status.
Right. In particular, one organization has really felt that we need more scientific information on the current population size across the range, and that information ought to be gathered first. Now, I just guess I'd point out that the IUCN red list is not a fixed thing, and it does come with a lot of provisos attached to it. And if you did look at our press release that we put out as the three organizations, while we acknowledge that the snow leopard is no longer in danger, we highlighted many times that it's still at risk, and that the last thing we need to be doing is to backing off on our conservation activities. We need to be, in fact, strengthening those, engaging communities in the snow leopard range more actively, reducing the conflicts that exist because of livestock depredation, and to improve their livelihoods so that they'd be more willing to coexist with a predator. And, you know, I'm all for research, but I think that there has been a lot of research, and I think that the donor public is looking towards making sure that their investments are leading to good results. And, you know, I think we can, in this case, say that snow leopards have come down a notch in their risk level. We don't know exactly how many there are there, but we're confident that we have some more time as long as we keep up the conservation initiatives. And so we are appealing for people and organizations and governments to invest in conservation and carry on the research. But what I fear is that if all the money goes into research and we have this very difficult question to answer of how many snow leopards there are out there, that we will lose momentum, that we will lose the support of the local communities. As you can imagine, surveying a cat that is very rarely seen, that lives above 10,000 feet generally, as high as 18 or 19,000 feet in extremely rugged terrain, is not an easy task, and it's going to take many years, I think, before we have a good, scientifically robust population estimate.
Well, and this is called the ghost cat because of its elusiveness and because it's so hard to find.
Exactly. It's, you know, I spent 40 years working on this cat, and it's really only recently, I would say in the last two decades, that I've had regular sightings of the cat. And all those sightings, without exception, have occurred in areas where the community has become actively involved in the conservation of the species. And, you know, you can imagine in 700,000 square miles, over 12 countries, often in sensitive or hard-to-reach border areas, that it's going to take us a very long time before we're going to be able to visit a good proportion of the range and have, you know, an accurate sense of how many cats there might be. So I would say let's continue the research, but at a lower level. Let's ramp up the conservation initiative so that we got more communities like those in Ladakh, where you can go and see a snow leopard and stand maybe as close as 50 meters away or 50 yards and see a cat and spend all day with it sometimes if it's on a kill.
That's Dr. Rodney Jackson. He is founder and director of the Snow Leopard Conservancy based in Sonoma. So this has been cause for a lot of people to be very happy for the change of status. I'm wondering then, what does the change of status really mean for a species? Can you look to other species whose status has been changed from endangered to vulnerable? And what that's meant for their population and for the conservation groups who have fought for their survival?
That's a good question, because not many species have been changed recently, I think in large part because the assessment process was somewhat subjective, and now that it's becoming more tied to global standards, I think we're going to have more of these sort of changes occurring. The one that comes to mind most prominently, I guess, is the giant panda from China. So that was endangered, and last year an assessment was done, and it was upgraded to vulnerable, or some people say downlisted. to vulnerable, the lower category, and it was done on the basis of number of animals and also especially the rate of change. So the Chinese have done a good job with protecting the habitat and securing, protected areas, working with local people so that the forests aren't cut down and the bamboo stands remain. I think that's a very good example of a situation where a change in status actually is a positive news, and it's not led to the government saying, oh, okay, we don't have to worry about it anymore. In fact, they've doubled their efforts, and they really secured that population.
But that is part of the concern, that once the status changes, then perhaps protections would not be as strong, or even perhaps the donor base that helps support some of these conservation efforts might lose attention to this and put its attention on more endangered species. I would imagine that's a concern for you leading an organization like Snow Leopard Conservancy.
Yeah, you know, I see it actually more from a positive viewpoint. I think it's a success, and I think we should be advertising our successes. We should not let up, of course. We still have to deal with threats that exist out there and in some cases increasing or changing. We don't know what the future might be in 5 or 10 years. We can make a guess, but it's totally a guess. And the Red List obviously has to be based more on real evidence. So I would say that we don't change our course of action, really, whether it's endangered or vulnerable. We keep on it, and we make sure that in 10 years' time, whatever our horizon time is, that we are meeting our goal of securing the future snow leopards. And there's a big initiative out there called the GSLIP, the Global Snow Leopard Environmental Protection Plan, to which all 12 range countries have signed up on. And its goal is by the year 2020 to secure 20 landscapes that have at least 100 snow leopards, that have a good prey base, that are being protected by the support of local communities and government. And I think that's the kind of goals we need to set that are very specific, numerically based, and that are realistic. And I certainly think this is a realistic one. If it comes to be, we're going to have at least 2,000 snow leopards. But given the size of the landscapes many governments have selected, I'm sure that the number can be much higher than that. The critical thing here is to make sure that those landscapes in the different countries are connected with one another by corridors so that we are maintaining the genetic viability of the snow leopard population.
With a different administration in Washington that seems to have less attention on environmental issues, certainly withdrawing from the Paris Accord, for example, is evidence of that. How do you feel about global conservation at this point and the status of it both in the United States and internationally?
In terms of the United States, I am hopeful, very hopeful, that the general public, the philanthropic sector, will step forward and fill the gap that the U.S. government is not filling for international wildlife right now. In fact, it's really losing a lot of the status that it had before, the recognition that it received both nationally and internationally. So I think that we are going to be able to mobilize the public. We are going to be able to explain that this is critical now, that we don't drop the ball, that we keep working and we work harder than ever before. I also see opportunities overseas. So in Nepal, for example, with the new constitution that they just in the process of implementing right now, moving to a federal system, more and more of their conservation initiatives are going to be implemented at the municipal level, which means that that general funding that was always a bottleneck to get at, controlled out of the capital city and subject to a huge amount of corruption, I suppose, is now going to be sent down to a lower level. That is not necessarily going to eliminate corruption, but I think it will reduce the level of it. More importantly than that, it gives an opportunity to local organizations. These might be even villager organizations like the Herders Group, to be able to go to the local council and request funding for conservation development activities.
I mean, because I think that living here in the United States, there's such great concern. It can be hard to keep that international perspective. It's interesting to hear what's happening in other governments around the world, which you have a great global perspective on.
Yeah, there's other countries, and especially European countries, EU countries in particular, have continued to increase their investment in biodiversity conservation in the developing world. And there's no indication they're going to change to that. I think many of the international foundations have also continued on their track. So it really is only our government that stepped back, unfortunately. And let's hope that that's just a short-term situation.